Welcome to the High Existence Podcast. This is John Brooks speaking. Today I am joined in conversation in the High Existence Dialogues with my amazing, wise, funny, interesting collaborators, Mike Slavin and Eric Brown. This is a really potent conversation all about the shadow, how to integrate the shadow, how to find our self-improvement blind spots and grow in all the areas we don't want to look at. This might be confronting as we prompt you to look into areas of your being that you typically avoid so that you can, what we call, productively procrastinate. This is a type of procrastination with the illusion that you are actually making progress, but instead you are just avoiding that one thing you should be doing most. An example of this could be someone who needs to have that very honest, raw conversation with their spouse and instead avoids it by going to the gym and reading books and meditating. All of these things have their root intention not to actually grow, but to avoid the real thing that will make you grow. So we go very deep into all of this in this conversation. I genuinely believe that if you implement the things that we discuss here, this discussion alone could vastly change the direction of your life. We share some of the best insights we've ever had in our entire lives in this conversation. But before we dive into that conversation, I just want to quickly tell you about our weekly newsletter, Down the Rabbit Hole. It's very new. There have only been 5 episodes, and people are telling us it's their favorite newsletter already. Every week, you'll get an injection of wisdom, wonder, and well-being sent straight to you. It's packed full of ancient and emerging tools, techniques, teachers to help you live a more meaningful, adventurous, and ecstatic experience of life. It's full of links, resources, our favorite findings on the internet, our favorite quotes. Every week you get our own prescription of things for you to investigate until the next newsletter is released. To sign up to our newsletter, check the show notes and you'll find a link, or go on highexistence.com/rabbit hole. highexistence.com/rabbit hole. I recommend you do that now so you don't forget. And when you've done that, let's get into today's episode.
All right. Welcome back to another High Existence Dialogue. This is Mike Slavin. I'm joined by the rest of the High Existence team, John Brooks and Eric Brown. Gentlemen, it's great to be here with you again to have another wide-ranging discussion about all kinds of stuff related to expanding our consciousness and exploring this wondrous experience we call life. I'd like to hear what's kind of on your mind today, guys. Is there anything that's floating around that you want to dive into, discuss, explore with one another?
It's great to be having this type of discussion with you as well. I always look forward to this. One of my favorite parts about it is not knowing what's about to come. Nothing here is pre-scripted. Everything is spontaneous. We are thinking out loud. And some of the ideas that we're going to be discussing aren't even 100% fleshed out by us. You might even hear us revise our own thoughts as we continue to go along in this dialogue. So it's very vulnerable in that way. A couple of topics that I'm thinking about lately. Well, I've been thinking about this for a few years, but my understanding of it is always shifting. And that is the idea of the shadow self. And I have to admit, I've never really gone deep into Carl Jung's work on this. My understanding of the shadow has come through other people who have read his stuff, and I've just had conversations about it, and I've just been thinking about it and fleshing out my own interpretation of it. And I think that's fine, because I'm not into the shadow from an academic perspective. I see it just as something useful, and what I understand the shadow to be is the most repressed, hidden, dark parts of your psyche that you don't want to acknowledge exist. Like, that's what I would say it is in a nutshell. And it's so dark and repressed and hidden that you can't even consciously access it in some way. That's why it's called a shadow. You need other people to point it out to you. You can't just sit here and go like, okay, I've got a shadow. I'm now going to go into that shadow and completely understand it. The shadow is cloaked within a blind spot. That's how I see it. But this is a good jumping off point. What are your guys' interpretation of the shadow?
Damn, that's a really good question. I actually had something come up during your definition, which was, it makes it seem like it's only things that you would deem unworthy or bad, but it can also have, I guess I would say it's anything that you reject or move away from or look away from in yourself. And yes, that can be, you know, being anger, jealousy, envy, a lot of these classic ones, but it can also have actually good characteristics in it as well. You know, if you were one of those kids who was always asking why endlessly as a kid, and eventually, you know, you'd upset the teacher or your parents or someone, and they'd be like, you know, stop asking questions. You know, can you stop that? Like, cut it out. Eventually, you'd come to associate your own curiosity with something that is bad, and you'd start to move away from it. You'd start to, like, involuntarily push it into your own shadow. And so even good parts of yourself, like assertiveness or curiosity or unbridled enthusiasm, can actually also, you know, find their way into your shadow, a part of you, parts of you that you don't want to look at. And, you know, I think for many of us, and it also seems to be growing in this space, right, the utility or the appreciation of shadow work. Because if there are parts of you that you're not willing to look at, you'll never feel whole. You'll never feel like a full person there. So yeah, I guess to answer your question, it would be any part of yourself you're unwilling to look at.
Yeah, I like this question, because similar to you, John, I haven't read, you know, the original works of Jung, and I haven't really spent too much time exploring the shadow with great rigor, but I do have a sense of it and my own intuition around what it means more like broadly, and also what it means more personally. And one of the components that jumps to mind is there's some form of repression that is experienced, where there is some aspect, some undesirable or you know, something perceived as a flaw is denied the existence in that person. Because it's so, it would be so emotionally challenging to accept that is a part of oneself. It gets repressed and denied, and then it creates, there's an association with projection, where it's easy for a person to discover or find these displaced or repressed elements of self in other people out in the world. And when they notice it in those other people, it creates a really strong, visceral, emotional reaction. And it's related to the extent of the repression. So whenever I see someone who's having a reaction that is seems like wildly sort of almost like disproportionately large given what I know about the context. Sometimes you see interactions where the way the person is responding to the circumstances just seems like they're blowing things out of proportion, when in reality there's a something deeper going on psychologically. And I think there's also an important point here to be made in how New Age psychology or New Age spirituality can be construed around this, where it's taken too far. If you see something that is unfavorable or quality in someone that you believe is actually not a good quality, or something that isn't generative or isn't supportive and is actually damaging, all of these things. That doesn't always mean that what you're seeing is a rejected part of yourself. It may mean that sometimes, but every time you have a judgment about someone does not mean that that is a disowned part of yourself that you are witnessing. Sometimes you're actually effectively discerning that that person is behaving in a way that is unsavory or perhaps abusive, so on and so forth. So I think that's there's a fine distinction there, and I think it's around the words judgment and discernment. Anything that smells like judgment in sort of a new age ethos is very easily, you know, sort of thrown aside. But I think there's an importance to recognize that when you're discerning and you see, oh, these patterns of behavior in this individual are patterns that I think are actually causing, you know, problems for them and the people in their world, and they might not be aware of it. Being able to see that does not necessarily make that something that you've rejected in yourself. So I think there's an interesting sort of dynamic there that can easily be sort of misconstrued or confused when we're talking about the shadow.
Yeah, what you just brought up made me think of the kind of circular logic that I often see in spiritual spaces that is often made fun of by people outside it. A classic one would be, anytime you have a bad psychedelic trip, it must be your old wounds opening back up. You know, it has to be that, you know. So it's like this circular reasoning that, you know, it kind of gets rid of the blame. Or, well, as you said, anytime you see something you don't like in another person, it's just a reflection of you, a reflection of your shadow. It's like, it's, you can't ever like reason out of it, you know. It's like this kind of, you're locked into it, and it's pretty dangerous, actually, I think, that type of thinking. And it can lead to the kind of like a mania, you know. You see it with people post ayahuasca sometimes, when they have this mania and everything is circular, you know. If you disagree with them, it's because you're stuck in the monkey mind. But I wanted to switch to what Eric said. This is really fascinating about the shadow. So Eric, you used this definition of the shadow is any part of yourself that you don't want to look at. Well, there's obviously a paradox there, because if you want to work on your shadow, then you want to look at it. But the shadow is always the thing you don't want to look at. If it becomes something you want to look at, it ceases to be the shadow. So how can you work on something that you don't want to see?
By pulling up your bootstraps and, you know, channeling some warrior energy. I think it is absolutely possible to do it, but most of us don't, because in its very nature, it's extremely unappealing, highly confrontational. It could actually just come at such extreme cognitive dissonance that it would collapse a lot of your identity structure or the value you've put on your actions or things. So there is just this immediate reflex to turn away from it, right? Because what is it? You know, ignorance is bliss, right? If I don't know about it, it can't shake the boat that much. But I think to your point, like a really effective sparring partner or intellectual sparring partner could bring these things to the surface for you and actually lay it out, like, hey, I notice that you're overly agreeable to a fault, right? You never disagree with people. You know, agreeableness is a huge one, or disagreeableness, I guess you could say, or the aversion to confrontation, I think, is something that goes in everyone's shadow, or at least certainly mine, right? And then there's this element of, well, you know, having teeth isn't bad, right? Having some bite to you is not a bad thing. It's just most people don't trust their ability to wield it, right? So they avoid ever actually doing it in the first place. And so there's this, you know, a term that piggybacks on all this is shadow work, right? You actually show up and you go to work slowly, like mining it. You go into the deep caverns with your little pickaxe of truth seeking, and you start picking away at what's actually there. You know, why do I always want to satisfy people? you know, why do I avoid disagreements? Where am I wrong? Like, it is, it's possible to do, it's possible to turn and face that, but it can just be so confronting that, yeah, we take the easy way out and we just look the other way and go back towards the things that we value in ourselves. But again, if you do that, you're always, in the end, at war with a part of yourself. And a person at war with themselves is a self-destructive pattern.
Yeah. Have you guys heard of this? I couldn't tell you what study it was from, but I hear it a lot. And it's like this notion that pretty much everyone believes that they're above average, or they when they assess themselves, yeah, they see themselves as above average in various ways. I'm not sure what that would be called in the literature, but it makes me think of this concept of a shadow. And as a person is sort of going about their life, what are the elements, the experiences that a person is having that they're kind of cherry picking to weave into the sort of self construct that they interact with? The way that they view themselves is clearly informed by a partial information set, right? It's not the whole, it's not the complete experience of the person's life. It's just pieces of it, and those pieces feel like they're selected by probably some unconscious process designed to protect the psyche from seeing things that might be too that might undermine its ability to function in the world. You know, if people really saw how bad they were at things, or the how much room there would be to grow too quickly, it might kind of buckle their knees under the weight of their own incompetence. So we find ways of structuring or relating to ourselves that allows us to believe we might be a bit better than we actually are. And I think there's this part of what I'm hearing you describe, Eric, is there's a humility, and there's also a turning towards that needs to happen in order to begin to invite some of these pieces, into our view. And I think there's also another tricky thing here where I bet, and this is where we can start kind of taking the conversation in a whole different direction if we choose to, but there are people who will do shadow work, but what they're really doing is performative shadow work. They've identified something that kind of sounds like, sure, okay, that could be something passing for being in your shadow, but it's something they actually have a better grasp on looking at, you know, from a more frontal perspective, and they're looking at it, but it really isn't the deep core. You know, it's more of a thing to hold on to and look at and play with, so that one can feel as if they are doing the shadow work. But it's almost like a mechanism of the shadow to continue to go undetected by using that kind of filling that slot with something that is not quite it, but, you know, can pass for it. So it creates this whole dynamic of distraction almost. And that isn't to say that it isn't useful to spend some energy on some of these things, but I certainly think that is there. I think the shadow is very tricky. That's one of the things when I think about it, it's like, I think about sleight of hand. I think about, you know, jester, trickster, just like we're so good at tricking ourselves and kind of losing track. These are some of the things that I feel, and this whole piece around finding sort of a pseudo shadow work to do in a performative way reminds me of this notion of spiritual materialism, or kind of wearing the badges of spirituality to demonstrate, you know, or to showcase a certain identity that we want to be seen or experienced by other people. And this is where, you know, those things start to connect. I'm curious where, you know, if you guys see spiritual materialism and shadow connecting in that way, or what the relationship is there.
I want to let Eric talk about the link, but I just want to add one thing to the thing you said prior about everyone, like a lot of people thinking they're above average. I read that in the book Irrationality by Stuart Sutherland, really, really great book on cognitive bias. And it's something like 95% of professors in universities think that they're above average. 80% of drivers think they're above average. you know, the numbers just don't add up. We many of us are just biased, and that's it. And what's interesting when you study about cognitive bias is that just because you study it, it doesn't necessarily protect you from it. And I think the same is totally true with shadow work. You could read 10 books on shadow work and have a very thick and addressed shadow. 100%. And I've actually seen this. It's really fascinating. And one could also argue that shadow work is never complete. You will always, you know, to the day you die, be uncovering parts of yourself that you're pushing away or have pushed away. And on some level, it's not enough to simply, I don't think, just say, like, I'm going to commit to doing shadow work. I think that's a really important first step. But to really integrate the shadow, you need other people. And I would just encourage everyone to look at their circle of friends and ask yourself, do you tend to surround yourself with people who just validate you and don't say, like, hey, I've got some feedback for you. I noticed you did this and I didn't like it. You know, do you have people in your life that say things like that to you and you actually take it to heart? You can tell the shadow is at work when you get feedback and you dismiss it. It's that feeling of dismissing that is the pushing away. So we've talked about this in previous dialogues, but being able to take feedback is one of the best spiritual practices you can ever do. Like, it's really simple. But if you want to do shadow work, really simple exercise, find 3 friends and just ask them, like, what are traits or behaviors that I've exhibited over the last year or two that have made you feel awkward or weird and you felt like you couldn't tell me about it. Boom, that's your shadow work right there. You know, you have about 6 months worth of personal growth exercises to go on.
Yeah, that was beautiful. So you kind of teed up my responsibility to paint a bridge here, which is going to be interesting. I think we'll get there in the end. I have a analogy I want to bring up first because I think it's really important. If you come down with an infection and you're prescribed antibiotics by a doctor, and you know you start your course of treatment and you're taking them and it's working and the bacteria or virus is going away, if you stop taking them before the full window is done, the bacteria actually comes back way stronger and way bigger than it did before. You actually had to go the whole way to get the result you were going for. And the same thing happens with something like shadow work or the spiritual flag of overcoming your ego or like transcending yourself. Because if you don't do it all the way, if you really haven't, if you get 75% of the way there, all that happens is it comes back way stronger, way more fierce, just in a different flavor. And this is where I think spiritual materialism comes into play most prominently, because the whole spiritual world does the same thing that they don't like in whatever you would call it, the normal world or the corporate world. You know, the pursuit and the accumulation of money just becomes the pursuit and accumulation of novel ceremonies, right? And it's just like you're doing the same thing, but painted under the colors and under the flag that you prefer. Yet at its core, it's still the same thing. It's the accumulation to support something that ultimately isn't really there, right? You're trying to bolster up your ego because you fear, like, what? I don't know, smallness, unimportance, something like that. But it's all the same thing, just done in a different way. You know, the same people who will be like, oh yeah, the accumulation of wealth is really bad, or these people are so full of themselves, they need to be a little humble, are the exact same people who are like, yeah, look at all this stuff I've done, look at all the books I know, look at all the quotes I can pull. Like, it's just the same thing under a different flavor. And I think where the bridge is like, oh, there's, and this is Mike's performative comment. It's like, oh, wait, there's actually a generator function below both of those things, right? The same driving force that leads to accumulating wealth and status is the same thing that leads to accumulating street cred and, you know, ceremony credentials. And instead of just saying, well, you know, I'm not pursuing the money stuff anymore, well, actually, there's something on a deeper level that you might not even have access to, which is, I think, John's point about it actually being difficult to see. But on some level, I think if you actually showed up enough for that question, you could probably get to, oh, well, it's because I feel very small and unimportant. And although my values have changed, right, from maybe, you know, money to being a light worker, I'm still pursuing the same thing. I'm still pursuing this aggrandized sense of self-importance or being the savior in a world that needs me. And it's like, yo, there is actually something below those. There's something deeper driving those. And just because you've changed the flavor, you're still eating the same ice cream.
Yeah, exactly. I think that ice cream piece really kind of puts the... like, that is the frame. And I'm thinking about, this is bringing up this really old distinction that I thought of. And it's been years since I've thought of this, but this feeling of, you know, what I call it, you can, these two perspectives you can hold in opposition, one being the acquisition model. And this is what you're describing, basically. It's a relationship to life in which a person, you know, this is a good analogy for it, where we're all born and we have a vest that we wear. And this vest is the canvas, the space in which we begin to acquire badges. And we can place on that vest as a way of displaying and demonstrating to others, you know, who and what we are. And there's sort of the mainstream badges that you can pursue that sound a lot like the fancy car and the money and the, you know, there's all these different kind of paths. But you can go and do the same kind of badge collecting with, like you're saying, these spiritual, like their ceremonies or their books or their all of these things that are just trappings of a spiritual identity. We're just trying to display and demonstrate to people, oh, I'm spiritual. Look at all of the badges that I have that say so, that communicate that. It's just, you know, you're just going to a different badge store. You're collecting them from a different place, but it's still that fundamental pattern of acquisition. And that pattern of acquisition feels to me often rooted in some sense of lack, a relationship to self that is not whole, but is requiring something out there in the world in order to satiate or make oneself whole. And I think there is this process of acquisition is in and of itself not bad. It's a kind of a very natural way to go about life of, you know, having pursuits, and it's a way that we can experience meaning. But I think there's without a deeper resting in some place deeper, it's easy for us to lose ourselves in these pursuits. And that would be the other perspective, which I call amplification, which is the recognition of almost expanding one's ability to experience presence and the ability to not get so disconnected in the pursuits of the future and trying to bring a future right now into, like, not being preoccupied with a world that's not here, but being preoccupied with the world that is immediately at our fingertips and at the fingertips of our senses, so to speak, that's like right there and present. And in that, recognizing that the vest was something that we've put on, you know, there's this fundamental confusion of all those things that we've collected that we identify with that is us, but it really isn't. It's just a way of communicating something, but there's something deeper to a human being. Call it a soul or a spirit or, you know, whatever you might call it. This is just one of the ways that I conceive of it. So I think that pattern of acquisition is very deeply ingrained, and again, not wrong, But without being grounded in a deeper recognition of who you truly are, it's easy to get lost in an endless pursuit of more badges. Because here's the thing, you know, it never ends. You never get to a point where you've covered up the vest with badges and you're like, great, I've done it. No, that's not how it works.
Yeah, I want to jump in really quick on that and say, because I think this is a point worth underscoring, say the same thing, just said differently. I can't remember who the original guy was, but I was introduced to this through John Vervaeke's series. And it was having needs and being needs, or the having mode and the being mode. Both of which are necessary for humans, but we get into trouble when we confuse the two. And so what he means by this is there are things that you have to have, namely the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, right? Food, shelter, water. These are things you actually need to possess. They are outside of you and you need to have them, you need to acquire them. They're absolutely necessary. But you also have being needs, which are, you could say, immaterial, right? Self-esteem, social relationships, right? A functional dynamic, you know, the pursuit of your own growth, right? A feeling of freedom and autonomy. And none of those things have anything really to do with the possession of anything physical. And we get into a trap when we confuse the two. You know, if you want more love, which is a being need, well, you don't do it by just having more sex, right? It's not a numbers game. It's actually something you have to enact. It's something you perform in the world. It's not something you just take and rack up, again, something like badges or a number. And so there is a place to having things, but I think it's way less than any of us really imagine. And particularly, I think for those who are interested in the spiritual pursuit, it's a lot more of a being thing. It's a how you act. It's a what you do rather than what you have. It can be almost decoupled entirely, which is where you get the really ascetic, like monk-like cultures, where it's like, actually, I need very, very, very little in the world because it's all just something that comes through my being. And so I love your acquisition amplification distinction there too. Many ways of saying the same thing, but it's super important. Like eventually, and probably for you, the thing you're actually searching is a way of being. It's not a thing that you need. There's not an end number. And I know John wanted to chime in on this as well.
Yeah, so many things are coming up from both of what you said. So Stephen Batchelor, he's a British author. He was a monk. I think he wrote a book called Buddhism for Atheists, and he's written a few other books. He's doing this project now where he's going back into the original Buddhist texts and kind of like an investigative journalist, like putting certain pieces back together to get a really clear roadmap of what the Buddha was teaching, you know, because it's been diluted and changed over thousands of years. And he believes that enlightenment is not like some state, but it's actually just acting in the world without hatred, greed, and delusion in a non-reactive way. It's like a very simple thing. It's like you're enlightened if you're non-reactive and you're not shackled to hatred, greed, and delusion. Think that's it. There's nothing super fancy about it. And it's much more of a being type of approach. It's like you can choose to be enlightened now if you want. You know, yeah, you can sit and wait for this like deep peace and joy to come, or you can just act in a non-reactive way and try your best to be free from hatred, greed, and delusion. That is, to me, like the spiritual path, as Alan Watts said, like a no-fuss spirituality, which I really like. And that also ties into the spiritual materialism with the no-fuss spirituality stuff. So I'm practicing martial arts, and I see jujitsu. I'm very passionate about this martial art, and I see a lot of people who are also passionate about it. And it's very tempting and easy to form almost like an identity around it, you know, where like my cover photo on Facebook is me in a jujitsu competition, you know, and I could quite easily change my profile picture to that too. and I could quite easily buy jiu-jitsu t-shirts, and I could want to be that guy that everyone knows he does jiu-jitsu, and then you form this jiu-jitsu identity about it. And the same can happen with literally anything. Spirituality is, of course, a really good one. And you see it. You do see people. You go on their Instagram, and it's just like, this guy just wants to scream down your face that he can fight. Okay, we get it. You know, like, we get it. You practice fighting. You're pretty good. We get it. Is that all there is to you? Like, who are you without this martial art? And yeah, I can see the temptation in it myself. And so the question is, how do you break free of it? How do you break free of spiritual materialism, identifying with this spiritual persona or this whatever persona you choose? And I think it's recognition and humor. I think it's okay to put a picture up on your cover photo of you in a martial art competition. But I'm also like kind of laughing at myself and seeing what's going on. You know, and then it's broken. You know, if I was very serious about it, like, everyone needs to know I can beat up people, then it's you're walking a slippery slope. And the same thing, like, if you want to put up a meditation image of you or something like that, cool, but like, laugh about it, realize what's going on. You want people to know that you're zen, that you're meditating, that you're probably calm, or whatever it is that you want some validation from it, probably. If you don't, you don't, but it's worth looking at that and trying to be a bit humorous with it. And that got me thinking as well about, you know, addictions. So from a Buddhist perspective as well, you know, we're addicted to many things, not just drugs. We're addicted to mind states. We're addicted to attachments and relationships with things. And if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing you have to do is admit that you're an alcoholic. You have to do a moral inventory. You have to say, like, this is my problem. This is where I'm at. You don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous and go, I'm not sure if I have a problem. It's like, you can't work from that place. So I want to tell you guys listening, and Mike and Eric, that I fall prey to spiritual materialism all the time. Like, all the time. I'm not above spiritual materialism. Sometimes say quotes to impress people. I sometimes tell people that I've read a book to impress people. I like to show people how many hours I've meditated. And if you're not willing to admit that you fall prey to spiritual materialism, that is one of the surest signs that you are actually shackled by it.
Yeah.
Because if spiritual materialism feeds on this idea that it's other people that have the problem. When you can actually recognize that you have it too, and it's kind of funny, and it's no big deal, it's just a part of you that's just expressing itself, now you've got something to work with.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's really, really interesting, because, you know, I love you voicing that, John, and I think it's important to maybe take a moment to emphatically state that in any of these dialogues or these conversations, you know, elucidating a dynamic or a pattern and being able to clearly describe it does not mean that, you know, I have or any of you have, you know, kind of extricated that pattern from the way that we interact with the world. Part of the reason I'm able to describe the things that I describe is because I've noticed them in myself up close. And a lot of, you know, that doesn't mean that they're eradicated, because I noticed them. And this came up a bit earlier as well, and it feels like there's a distinction, a really useful distinction between, and I think of the sort of Vervaekian ways of knowing, particularly propositional, which is you can conceive of the sort of concept and the intellectual structure of it in your mind. And then there's procedural, so how you actually move about the world and how you're actually behaving and interacting with the world, and that is there's another way of knowing. There's another piece there of the way that you operate in the world. And just because you can hold something in propositional knowing, does that mean it will directly translate to procedural, to the way that you interact with the world? And I think this is a key mistake that is easy to make, where people, you know, they read a book and they feel like because they have an understanding of a concept that now they are no longer subject to experiencing to experiencing that concept because they can see it and understand it. Now, it may be true that given that they have a greater understanding, that affords them a greater degree of being able to catch these patterns when they arise. But it does not ensure that those that the patterns do not arise. Reading, you know, cutting through spiritual materialism by Chögyam Trungpa does not mean that you are no longer, you know, that you're impervious to spiritual materialism yourself. So this is, you know, it's just a nice giant pill of humility, and it also it's related to sort of John's notion of being humorous with it, not taking things so seriously. You know, it's like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that I, there are all these things that I do and all these kinds of ways that I'm unpolished, and that's okay. You know, like, it being okay, I think, is a step to not sort of pushing it down into the dark recesses of the mind, or, you know, kind of create it, turn it into a shadow tendency, because we believe we need to have some kind of perfectly polished spiritual representation of ourselves. That's just, no, it's silly. You're a human being with imperfections and flaws, and it's almost humorous the ways that, you know, that we are flawed, the ways that we can be, you know, bumbling fools in the world. And to see that and honor that is I think probably one of these pieces. It's in the relationship of ourself that may allow us to get a greater glimpse at these things that we otherwise would repress. It might be one of those levers that you can pull if you hold things more loosely and engage life sincerely but not seriously, then you allow yourself to, you know, maybe catch a glimpse of these things that you would otherwise try to stuff in the closet or in the basement or the attic. You know, choose your sort of dark place that fits for you in that metaphor. But I think that, yeah, all of these pieces are really interesting to sort of consider.
Yeah, and I think we're now touching, I don't think the word's been brought up yet, but it's certainly something we've been hovering around, because all of these are interrelated. That is spiritual bypassing, where you actually just be like, to your point, Mike, it's like, oh no, I actually know about cognitive biases. Now I've transcended them entirely, bro. Like, you're still working with that? Like, come on, that was so 2 years ago. And that I think, to John's point as well, is the whole point. And I think that is the unifying thread between shadow bypassing and materialism, which is, if you think that thing is just for other people, like, that's the point. That's where all the work is, because it's not, because they're a human just like you. That means you can express all the same things. We literally spoke about this in Dialogues 2, and this is the classic Jordan Peterson shadow work example of, like, try to picture yourself being motivated to be a guard at Auschwitz in Nazi Germany, and you probably could. And if you think, oh no, only that person is so evil that they would do that, well, no, that's just not at all true. Like, you have the capacity to enact that. And if you think you don't, again, that's just a part of yourself you're not looking at. Or if you think, no, I've transcended that, it's only love and light, like, no, dude, the conditions just haven't put you there. So I think that is a unifying thread of, like, if you see it in other people, you can see it in yourself. And then again, it almost full circles back to, well, there has to be a bit of, like, warrior energy. It's like, oh shit, this applies to me too? How does it apply to me? How can I go about seeing where I'm still coming or still playing these things out? And, you know, that will lead you down some very powerful pathways, because it's like, if there's something I don't like in other people, I think Mike, you spoke on this earlier, there's a distinction between the actual value judgment you make about someone's actions and your actual just raw capacity to do the same thing. You always have the capacity to do the same thing, but it doesn't mean necessarily that you will, because you can actually see that, you know, well, actually, that's a little immoral. Actually, that goes against my ethics. Like, yeah, there is, you can recognize that in yourself, but that doesn't mean you're incapable of doing it entirely. And I think that's where we really begin the process of shadow work, like, oh shit, how am I actually able to do this? Or even better, how do I actively do this and just tell myself otherwise?
Yeah, that, it's really interesting. There's this way of looking at it where, you get close to people and you can start to see their shadow tendencies, right? But I don't know if you could really see it in a way that holds it in its full view, like compassionate and without a sort of seething judgment or, feel like loathing or any of these things in noticing these shadow tendencies because of that recognition and the humility that you're speaking to, Eric, around, oh yeah, I also have the capacity for this. If I was sculpted by the world in the same way that this person had been, I might have similar tendencies, and I also might not even be able to witness these tendencies or even recognize their presence in the way that I interact with the world. It just wouldn't even occur to me. And then it's like, oh, this opens up so much space for compassion, for someone if they're behaving or acting in a way that we would deem reprehensible or just not, just like, man, you really shouldn't scream at your mother that way, something like that, or it's just like, that seems, what's going on? Recognizing that, but then like, yeah, there's something where the compassion almost feels like it serves as an appropriate medicine almost. If you can witness someone in their shadow tendencies, but do so where you're not sort of permitting their behavior, but you're accepting that the world and their participation in the world has shaped them in such a way that this is how they're acting, and to witness them in that, then almost it can open the door for them to recognize it themselves, because they feel like, oh, okay, this person is seeing this part of myself that I've likely rejected or am not willing to take a deep look at, and I also feel that they see it in me, but they also still love me, and that can open the door for these rejected pieces to begin to surface in consciousness, or at least it would seem to me that would be the case.
So good, so many important points, and I want to try and take this now and take some of what we've discussed and give people some practical things that they can actually like do, because we've talked so much in this conversation about what I would consider knowing is not enough. Like that might be the how I would summarize it. Like, knowing is not enough. Knowing about the shadow is not enough. Knowing about cognitive bias is not enough. How can we take this information and use it to improve our life? So how does one work on spiritual bypassing? How does one integrate their shadow? So I've mentioned it already and I'll mention it again. No fuss spirituality. I like very much this idea of the secret sage, becoming someone who doesn't necessarily wear their spirituality on their face. You don't need to tell people about your meditation practice. You don't need to broadcast it to people. That's like a very simple thing. And if you feel like you need to, then that's something to investigate. How about you just don't talk about your meditation practice for the next year? How does that feel to you? Does that give you some anxiety? Like, oh, but it's a hobby of mine. Well, okay. Why is it a hobby of yours to talk about your meditation practice? Something to investigate. So having like a no fuss spirituality thing going on, where if someone is asking you, do you meditate? Do you have any advice on meditation? Fair enough. Talk about it. Another one is stop giving advice that's not asked for. Like, if you find that you're like gravitating towards people who have a problem so that you can tell them what to do and in the process signal to them how much you know about spirituality, then that's not a good idea either. So be very mindful of how you give advice to people. Be very mindful of how you broadcast your spiritual practices to the world. And have some secret, not secret, but have some like no fuss spiritual practices. Keep it to yourself. You don't need to fall into line with the new spiritual fad. You can be the most spiritual person in the world and be, to all appearances, regular. You know, it's totally compatible. Like, you know, the more spiritual you are, it doesn't mean you need to like have incense burning in your home and statues of the Buddha and, you know, whatever the spiritual stereotype is. You can just be like your next door neighbor, but be high in awareness and compassion. Like, job done. So yeah, I'll kick things off with that sentiment.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. I'm going to bookmark that and come back to it. I first want to draw a distinction. I think there are different practices for whether you're trying to dig into your shadow or you're trying to dig into the materialism, spiritual materialism side of it. The shadow, I think, is really, I don't want to say straightforward, but it seems like this whole process is, well, first you have to be aware of it, right? There are two ways that you can become aware of your own actions. I guess three. One is active contemplation, right? So sitting down and actually asking, like, what am I unwilling to feel? What parts of myself do I reject? And actually seeing what comes up. The other is mindfulness, right? Actually just seeing, oh, whenever someone says something to me like that, I default to shutting them down. That's interesting. And then if you ask why, you go into contemplation and you can really dig into the root of that. And the third way being actually what John said, relentlessly pursue feedback from people, particularly those who spend a lot of time with you. Like, a lot of people say they want more richer conversations with their friends, so I challenge you next time you're with your friends to straight up be like, what parts of me don't you like? How do I bother you the most? Right? What's something that I miss in myself? And see what comes up. Some of it could be highly confronting, and some of it could be highly beneficial. And then picking up on your bookmark, because I think it's extremely important about the materialism thing and just not telling anyone anything. Like, if the idea of that bothers you, that is highly fruitful territory. Like, what if you just never spoke about any of your personal work ever again to anyone? Would that be a problem? Because we, you know, a lot of us will say, yeah, you know, I do this work because I want to cultivate a connection with everything around me, with the divine, with the mystical, with the mysterious. And it's like, okay, what part of that direct channel to the transcendent requires you talking about it to other people? I don't know which religion it was, or maybe it was just an individual, but they said, you know, you should never pray in public. Right, your relationship with God is entirely individual, and you should be in your room and do that because that's just for you and him, or you and it, or, you know, whatever word you want to use there. But I think that's really, really important, because the second we make, oh, you know, I'm meditating so that I can talk to other people about this, well, you've now made a dependency, which you could easily translate as, oh, there's a badge. Right? Maybe I'm a teacher, maybe I'm an influencer, maybe I'm a guide. And it's like, wait, that's different. That end goal is different than the one you state actively, which is self-cultivation and your own relationship to what's going on here. So actually, I think one of my favorite ways, and this has flipped it a lot for me, I think I first read it from David Hawkins. He was like, well, actually the spiritual path is more yin, like submitting, receiving, rather than a masculine, like outgoing, gain more, learn more, do more. It's actually just a continuous letting go. You know, why do I need to impress people? Why do I need to show up in this way? Why is this better? And you just let go layer after layer after layer until you, you know, end up basically merging back with everything. You're like, I'm a part of this, and that knowledge, that embodied knowledge in itself is enough for me. I don't need anyone's validation. I don't even need my own validation, because I can just rest comfortably in that. And so, yeah, I would just question any time anything you do is dependent on having it go back out to other people. And I think this is super prevalent for all of us, you know, being people with an audience, people with a reach. You know, there was a reason I wanted to write for people, right? And, you know, I think it's worth noting that, again, we are not invulnerable to this. I think it's highly prevalent, and it's very fruitful to dig into that. Why do I want to show up for people? Why do I need them to see me? Why do I want to project my identity in this way? Do I view it as better? Do I view it as necessary? Could I talk to someone and them never compliment me about anything? Like, yeah, you can get to a place where the answer is yes, but it might take you a little more work than you think. And that's why a metaphor for this is always something like a path. But then the joke is that, you know, it was never a path. You never had to go anywhere. You never had to do anything. You just had to drop it. You could drop it all right now, but it'll probably take you some work.
Yeah. There's so much in there. And one of the things that really jumps out at me is, you know, considering it's just where it's like, it's really crazy how these dynamics get, you know, because if you go and ask your friends, which I don't think is a bad exercise. And I think, you know, these friendships, there needs to be a foundational level of trust built, or a really kind of a strong ability to receive feedback without creating a self-punishment dynamics. If someone says something you don't like about yourself, you know, it's like, okay, can you avoid spiraling down into a pit of despair because someone said something that was unfavorable? If you have a hard time doing that, then that exercise still might be worth doing, but it what you'll get out of it is a bit different. It wouldn't be the content of what the person says and more your own reaction to what they say and how you process and deal with that. And I think another thing to be sensitive to is people can share the things that bother them about you, and that's actually their own shadow material that they're revealing. You know, it's like, hey, you know what bothers me about you is you're really like outspoken and you talk a lot, and I think that you just need to give other people space to speak. And that could be that person's own difficulty of claiming their voice, sort of showing its head. And so there's an interesting thing with this, with those kinds of prompts, where I think a person has to really digest or recognize that the person who's delivering feedback is themselves, like there's no feedback that comes without a person and all of their shit attached to it. You know, there's like they're speaking from a certain perspective and a place. And so you can't take any of it with a grain of salt, because it might not be. You know, you don't want to get to a position where every time someone says that says something, hey, I don't like this about you. Oh, wow, let me change that about myself. You know, it might not be that it's something that's worth changing, or that is even, that it might not even be your shit. But I think it's an interesting experiment, you know, if you begin to consider, oh, if I'm around a friend and I ask them, hey, what don't you like about me? You know, that could be a very uncomfortable question, but it's also really useful to see what arises in you. And it's okay that there are things that people don't like about you. It's okay that there are things that aren't the most, I don't know, like polished. It helps kind of eradicate a sense of perfectionism. And I think to briefly touch on, you know, on a practical note, I think, you know, we can talk about this all day, and there's all kinds of distinctions and nuances and all of that stuff, but a practice of compassion for yourself and the world around you is so vital and so essential. And just recognizing that, you know, your humanity and your imperfection and being compassionate as you pursue that process is one of the vital things from my perspective, because it opens up the space for you to see the things that are unsavory about yourself. Without that, without having a broader compassionate love, almost like the love of a mother to a child or a father to a child, that's unrelenting and so deep, that runs so deep, you know, that's not just, oh, like, you know, it's almost like welcoming back in the rejected part of oneself with open arms, even if it looks like a demon, you know, or whatever it may be. It's you know, inviting that back in.
You bring up a really, really, really good point, Mike, about asking people for feedback and how that could be potentially dangerous. So on that note, what I would say is that there needs to be like a ton of consistency. Like you don't want to be working on like 50 different things at the same time that is wrong with you. You know, it should be like you ask 10 people and there's like one thing that's kind of consistent among all of the responses. That's like the one thing to work on. It's usually, you know, I've had friends that they just talk too much all the time. They dominate the conversation, and I found it very difficult just to tell them, you know. But I know that other people have felt the same way about them as well, and it's just this tricky thing. So that's like something like that. It's like if someone like that asked a lot of people, you know, with kindness, is there anything I do that kind of annoys you from time to time? And a polite response was like, yeah, well, sometimes, you know, I feel like I can't get my opinion across when I'm talking to you. So, okay, note. Next person, something similar, note. And when you've got like 5 people telling you that, then it's something to be like, okay, cool. In the next conversation I have, I'm going to really notice that within myself and try and validate it. You don't want to be working on like 50 things wrong with you at any one point. It's like 1 or 2 broad things, like, are you too agreeable? Do you dominate conversations? Do you snap out at people? Do you like kind of bend the truth? You know, like very simple stuff like that. And in terms of practical steps for integrating the shadow, we've already talked about what Jordan Peterson recommended. I also love that approach. But one exercise I think is super useful, and people don't really talk about it much: look at your environment for clues about your shadow instead of looking into yourself. So start seeing your reality, your external world, as a painting of your own neuroticism. So start seeing your external world as a painting of your own neuroticism. And I mean this like quite literally. Like, if you have just met someone and you spent a weekend with them and now you've moved in with them, cool, you know, like I'm sure you're in love, but there's a reason you've done that, you know, and that's worth exploring. You know, why did you just move in with someone after 2 days? Another one could be, you don't tend to have, you know, heart-to-heart with your parents, heart-to-heart conversations, and you're telling yourself the story that they have no time for you. It's like, okay, maybe that happened 10 years ago, but when's the last time you even tried to have a heart-to-heart with them? Are you just telling yourself that, or are you actually creating that because you have like a neurotic fear around certain conversations with your parents? There are so many examples, like, you know, people who like to complain about the job that they hate is another one, you know, and that job is actually satisfying them on a really deep level because now they get to complain. They get to have these kind of like victim discussions with their friends. Everything in your life, every relationship, the dynamic at work, your family, not all of it is up to you. A lot of it is outside of your control, but a lot of it is a result of your own decisions and your own self-belief and what you think you deserve out of life. So start examining everything around you and start asking, how is my neuroticism shaping my life?
Yeah, this is super powerful. Another way I like to say that is, you always get what you want. You just have to reconcile what it is you actually want. Because to your point, John, yeah, a lot of people right now just want to, you know, what came up for me is playing the victim, right? Victim mentality. Oh, my job is so hard. Oh, my relationships aren't fulfilling. It's like, yo, you see that you need those things to be able to fit that identity. If you didn't have anything to complain about, how could you possibly be a victim? So actually, you've created a life that enables that as well as possible for you. And then yes, now it's just this is again, you know, looking at the shadow where it's like, oh, this is actually what I wanted. this is actually the dynamic that I wanted for myself. You know, I wanted to be in a toxic relationship because I felt that's what I was worth, and now it's validating the story I told myself about myself. And that's very hard to look at, but it, again, can be incredibly fruitful. And I want to bring up a point that, or at least a word that Mike mentioned earlier, which, again, becomes more and more important in this space, which is discernment, right? Everything everyone says has both signal and noise. And it actually can be quite difficult to piece the two apart, right? Because if you ask anyone and they say anything, you know, you are a part of their world. What they say back to you will have some signal, but it will probably have a bunch of noise too, right? It could be their own projections, could be their own shit, right? It's not always as clear cut, but to act like everything everyone says has signal or is just garbage and is only noise, both of those are wrong. Like there's something in there for both of them. You know, another fun way this is I think a lot of people who find their way into the spiritual world end up vilifying science and logic and reason and rationality at their own peril, right? We just end up with a bunch of people with really shoddy metaphysics. They have a weird-ass story they tell themselves about people and others. It's filled with logical inconsistencies. And it's like, this stuff actually becomes more and more important the more and more weird you get. The more out there into the subjective nature of reality you get, the more you actually need tools and a toolkit to cut through what is garbage here, what is inconsistent, what was just a one-off random encounter with an entity, and what's a real thing. Like, it becomes more and more important, and yet we throw all of that out the window, or many of us throw it right out the window when we start, because it's like, oh yeah, you know, science and nihilism and the dead world is what got me into this mess, and now I just need to drop it completely to get out of it. It's actually like, no, it's a very valuable tool, particularly as you're carving your way through this maze of, you know, people's interpretations and projections, your own freaking shadow. There's a whole lot, and it becomes more and more important to be discerning, to have logical consistency, because I think to John's point, your life will snowball in the direction of the missing gaps there. It's like the path of least resistance, right? Ooh, there's a hole in your reasoning, so it's just going to go right there, and then your life will become a result of that. So it becomes more and more important, you know, discernment, logic, reason, rationality, as you venture more and more into the spiritual, mystical, esoteric worlds. They complement each other. They're necessary for each other. And you can actually go deeper in both by using them both effectively.
Love it. I want to circle back to this piece that John was talking a little bit about. You know, we'll use the example of the person who talks a lot. And to use that to kind of map out a broader pattern of the ways that we adapt to our environments and our circumstances. So, and this invites compassion. That's why I bring it up to you know, also spell out more reasons why we should have a compassionate stance towards ourselves. And that's due to, in a lot of cases, dysfunction exists in us because at one point in time it was adaptive. It fit a context very nicely and allowed us to survive and navigate that context by learning and deploying that particular strategy. And then as time passes, we begin to deploy that strategy inside of contexts in which it's not appropriate, but because it's what we've learned and what we, you know, have gotten, what we've succeeded in the past, we just kind of reflexively just operate that way and might not even realize that it's inappropriate in those contexts. So for instance, someone who talks a lot, it may be that they had a parent who never really listened to them. And they, even if they're nodding and you know, posturing as if they were, this person, in order to try to feel heard, they would just endlessly or relentlessly talk to try and get some semblance of connection. Maybe I'll say something that they'll pick up and hear and listen. And just kind of relentlessly pursue that. And that's just one possibility. There's all kinds of reasons that someone might develop that tendency. You know, maybe they grew up in a house of five or six other kids, and there's always so much going on that you couldn't, you know, it was really hard to be heard. So you just had to, you had to be as loud as you possibly could. And just, if you spoke enough, then, you know, eventually you could get, you would get listened to. And there's all different kinds of examples that we could raise here. But I think the key piece is this invites compassion, because these strategies that we learn are, we're adaptive in a certain environment, and that part of us is actually was trying to help. So it in recognizing that, the sort of extending your hand to invite it in from a more welcoming place is easier to accomplish, because otherwise these parts of ourselves that are unsavory or that we think other people really judge or dislike, we almost want to chop them off. We don't want to accept that they're a part of our being, you know, and that's why they can get relegated to the shadow in the first place. So really seeing this and, oh, wow, okay, yeah, that part of me actually, in some weird way, it's trying to help me. And it might not, you know, might not be doing, you know, an effective job, but it at some point in time, that, you know, there's that sort of innocent spirit to it. Okay, wow, that changes how I feel about it. Now I feel like I'm more sort of open to this piece of myself and less, you know, coming from this place that I need to chop it off or extinguish it from my existence. I can integrate it. I can actually witness it and look at it and participate with it as a part of myself, not just this disfigured, dysfunctional, you know, pattern or that I wish I could not do, you know. So I raise that because I really want to invite people listening to this to practice compassion with themselves in all the, you know, in all the ways they find themselves struggling or you know, not measuring up to their own standards or whatever it may be.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think there's also just a starting point of, again, really useful of, why do you feel the need to neurotically fix yourself in this way? Right, and actually starting at that point, you know, I like the phrase, like, the cult of busyness, and I think this is what drives a lot of spiritual materialism as well. Right, there's the whole working world corporate side of it where it's like, yo, you have to justify your right to exist and like work, prove your value. But then we just switch that over to, again, the accumulation of, oh, well, I understand how to live because I've read all this philosophy, I've studied the world religions and I know these things. All the while forgetting the fact that, like, why did you ever view yourself as incomplete in the first place? Like, if you want to play the game of, what would you call it, growth, exploration, that's awesome. Like, please come play with us, right? That's how this whole community was formed here, because we really enjoy playing this game. But again, there's an element of taking yourself lightly where it's like, don't forget that, you know, you're not fundamentally broken right now. Like, don't start from the place of lack. Start from the place of opportunity. Like, oh, wow, I feel like I could get some really good relationships. I could get a really good... I can see the beauty that lies along this path. And so, cool, I'm going to walk it. But again, it's not a... I think if you're going to start anywhere, start there. Why do you feel the need to justify your existence? Right? Why do you feel like you're not enough? And if you can resolve some of that, where it's like, yo, you're actually a part of the beautiful evolution of humanity, like, you're whole and complete as you are, and you could play a cool game with a bunch of people, like, cool, then let's do that, and we can dig into all of this stuff. But there does seem to be, like, a pre-qualifier of, why do you feel the need to do this in the first place? It should be an opportunity. It shouldn't be a force. You shouldn't be forced into it. Right, it should actually be a chosen game that you come play with really fun players, but not if you're... This is a line in Finite and Infinite Games, right? No one can play freely if they're forced to play. And so I think there's a starting point there too.
Yeah, and that also brings this notion of compassion and into my mind. Mm-hmm. Having that, you know, that it's so deeply conditioned into us, what you're speaking to, that, and it's like, it's so such a part of the culture, you know. You go out in the world, make something of yourself, be somebody, you know, all of that kind of stuff. it's the same thing as the acquisition mindset. It's the same thing as what we're talking about. It's where spiritual, you know, materialism is a subset of this larger pattern of pursuit and fixing and trying to almost build the self that might someday be worthy, that people kind of get caught up in. And there is this more foundational realization or relationship towards oneself that can enable and open up, you know, really, really profound doors. But if spirituality or shadow work or any of it is being used as an implement to try and fix yourself, and it's coming from that stance, then I think the jumping off point is a bit misguided, and it's kind of moving forward from false pretenses. We all have our issues. We all have ways that we struggle, but those struggles, those issues, those, you know, ways of dysfunction do not crowd out our beauty. They do not, you know, make us any less wonderful. In some ways, they can add real, like, additional beauty to us. The ways that we do struggle, you know, to make it and to navigate in this world. So there's so much, there's so much richness in this conversation. And, you know, I've enjoyed kind of slicing up these different pieces related to shadow work and spiritual materialism. I feel like we just grazed on spiritual bypassing, but it's very much related, you know. I feel like spiritual bypassing is produced by the shadow and those kinds of tendencies, you know. It's like they're all kind of in the same sort of space or landscape. But I think we want to begin to wrap up this call. Is there anything that you guys want to leave the listeners with? Any sort of final parting thoughts that that you feel really called to share before we unplug and you know, move about our days?
So it relates back to the shadow and shame. I think shame is one of those emotions that is very painful and causes us to push things down when we feel a sense of shame about something. Like, we feel shameful about something that we've done or some habit that we engage in, or it could be anything, but just there's a sense of shame. One of the most healing things you can do is to go into that shame and find reasons to be grateful for it, and just, like, really take ownership of it. Speaking from my own life, for a long time I carried around this, like, weight on me. I felt like I was flawed or broken or defected, and it was just shame, basically, and I didn't have the right operating system to be able to navigate it. And then, you know, what do you know, I meet some people that are incredible and I'm vulnerable in front of them, and they're just like, yeah, cool, I see you, it's all good, we're all human. And suddenly this weight that I'd been carrying around was lifted, this story that I'd been telling myself that I was broken, that I was always doomed to this terrible existence. Like, it was just like a neurotic pattern, like, went just overnight, because I was able to be vulnerable with people and to let other people see my shame. So earlier I mentioned, for shadow work, you know, get feedback from people, but yeah, like, not just feedback, love, you know, look at love from people, make connections, find like-minded people, and open up. I don't know, I haven't met anyone yet who thinks that opening up and being vulnerable with people who are vulnerable back does anything other than beautiful things. So yeah, just want to leave you with that.
Yeah, that's spot on. I think a few really quick things come up for me. One is, I fully agree with Mike of just radical compassion radical compassion, and to John's point, radical acceptance. Just full compassion for yourself and others, because the human thing is hard enough, and everyone is doing a good job, you're doing a good job. And yeah, the power of just relentless acceptance of the individual is remarkably healing. Yo, you can show me any side of your humanity, and I will appreciate it because I have that capacity too, because I'm also human, and you're beautiful because of it. And then, the thing that came up on Mike's question for like a parting word is, one of the most powerful, I think, frame switches for me has been, what if this whole thing, and by thing I mean like the spiritual path, is actually about removing and taking away and letting go, rather than learning and forming models and doing the work. And that has been extremely rich, like just letting go of the, you know, need for an identity, the need to posture, the need to be busy, the need to prove, the need to get validation. All of those things are letting go. And I don't know, at least I've found, like, as I was able to do that more and more, it's just, A, you become untouchable because you're not really defined by anything, but B, you're just this open space for everyone, and you can give that gift of full acceptance and holding space for people, because it's, you know, you're an empty vessel, and people can just come and load you up, and they can unload the weight of their world on you, and then it flows through you because there's nothing to hold on to. And so, yeah, I think that's just a useful, maybe it'll just be a thought experiment, like, what if this whole thing is actually about letting go rather than gaining more? And I think that can take you to some really fruitful places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's also, I hear letting go, and another way of saying it might be giving away. Is I had this vision, this like, you know, I saw it in my head of this experience, like the kind of inverse, what you're describing basically, where, you know, we're racing to oblivion, like we're all dying, everyone will die. That's, we already know that. And it's like, well, when you take it in that context and you just see someone who's just like trying to grab as much stuff as possible before they fall into the abyss, it just seems silly. Mm-hmm. Versus the experience of giving away what one has to give throughout the course of their life, being more focused on that, the giving, than the acquiring and the gaining. So then you arrive at the abyss sort of exhausting, or just having poured yourself out into the world, rather than almost trying to deny the oblivion that awaits, or, you know, at least the foundational transformation as you cross through the threshold of death. It feels like in some ways the desire, the need to acquire is an attempt to deny death. It's an attempt to deny that fate that awaits us all by if I can just have these things, it almost like enhances or creates more reality, gravity around me, or something like that. But it's not. You can't beat it. Death is something that awaits us all. And so in fully recognizing that, then it's that it can give a sense of preciousness, you know, to the things, to the world that we experience, to the people in our lives. And so, yeah, I think to wrap up, I would just say, you know, give yourself a break, cut yourself some slack. There's all kinds of ways that we can be, way too hard on ourselves. And it's okay to make mistakes. It's a new day. You can make new choices starting today. And I think to really jump off of what John shared about shame and being vulnerable with people. I mean, that's really, really what it's about. Because all this acquisition stuff is, you know, trying to collect these badges. It's never really satisfying, because the version of ourselves that we're portraying to the world is a version that we know deep down isn't who we really are. And so even if we are accepted for that version we're portraying, it doesn't satiate, because it isn't really us, you know? And we know that. And then there's this fear that, wow, if someone did really see me for who I am, they wouldn't accept me. So I have to, you know, painstakingly maintain this image that I'm trying to present to the world. And it creates a prison. It creates an experience that is very, very uncomfortable, to say the least. So I think really aiming for relationships that allow for that, allow for the expression of the rawness and the messiness. Not because expressing those things, you know, requires people to, you know, do us a favor. Oh, thank you for listening to that messiness, or thank you for receiving my vulnerability. It's not a favor. It's nourishing to those relationships. It's beautiful to experience someone in their pain. Not everyone's capable of really receiving it, but those are the friends that are worth finding. And those are the relationships worth building and maintaining. And the more you share, and the more you allow yourself to be vulnerable with people, the more you can, you know, hold that vulnerability within yourself. You get a sense that, oh, it is okay. And then, you know, a lot can open up from there. But I could go on and on talking about these things. But I think this is a nice place to wrap up here. John or Eric, if you have anything else additional you want to say, like, please jump in. But very much enjoyed this conversation, and it's always good to interact with you guys. And I hope for the listener this was valuable, this was useful. You got something, some nugget that you can take away as you go about your day.
Thank you for listening to the High Existence Podcast. If you want to stay up to date with all of the podcasts that are being released and get all of our favorite findings on the internet, our favorite book recommendations, our favorite links, videos, podcast recommendations, and everything else, then please sign up to our newsletter, Down the Rabbit Hole. You can find that link in the show note, or you can find that link in the show notes, or sign up at highexistence.com/rabbit hole.